Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. We have a special bridge today, a mystery, the case of the vanishing seals.
This is Seal, a marine mammal mystery told in bite-sized chunks. I'm John Ryan. The story is true.
An Alaskan Island Mystery.
We'll have that story in just a few minutes. Also, diverse groups of people are coming together across the state to campaign for more protections of the Owyhee Canyonlands in southeast Oregon. They say the Owyhee's tranquility comes from its remoteness and lack of development. We'll hear comments from Robin Jansen, a river guide for Momentum River Expeditions, and Chad Brown, executive director of Soul River. The conservation group Cascadia Wildlands has submitted an ethics complaint against three Oregon state representatives, alleging they misrepresented legislation during the hearings to delist the gray wolf. This is The Bridge for the week of May 5th. Edward Stratton of the Daily Historian has our first story. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers wants to know how wetland restoration efforts are benefiting juvenile salmon as they feed in the mouth of the Columbia River on their way to the Pacific Ocean.
Trying to answer that question are multiple field teams working under the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the U.S. Department of Energy's Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. Fisheries biologist Lori Whitecamp leads one of the field teams that catch, dissect, and preserve migrating juvenile salmon on the main stem of the Columbia River. The samples they collect tell researchers how fish indirectly benefit from the wetlands they pass by. On a misty Friday morning, Whitecamp and her contracted research and boat crew from Ocean Associates Incorporated headed out of the Olokamin Slough Marina in Cathlamet to trawl for several minutes in the main channel of the Columbia next to the Julia Butler Hansen Wildlife Refuge. Docked back in Cathlamet, Whitecamp and her crew go to work processing the hatchery yearling Chinook and wild steelhead trout caught in their net. They take blood samples from the fish. After gutting and removing the livers, Whitecamp freezes the organs in dry ice and puts the remaining fish on ice. Back at the Point Adams Research Station, researchers will remove more parts of the salmon, including the stomach, intestines, ear bones, gills, and a fin clip, before sending the specimens to various National Marine Fisheries Science Center labs from Newport to Seattle. The researchers look for quick indicators of growth related to time spent in the estuary, such as the animals' diets and nutrients gleaned from the nearby food sources. Related studies look at younger salmon who spend weeks to months in the wetlands, and nutrients that flow from those wetlands into the river's main channel for quickly passing migrants. Whitecamp's group will continue sampling at various locations along the lower Columbia from Bonneville Dam to the Astoria Bridge, collecting samples to send to NOAA's labs. Kurt Fresh, principal investigator with the project, said all the fieldwork will go into a final report to the Corps to better show the linkages between fish and wetlands. Fresh said there are many organizations spending a lot of money on wetland restoration. The goal of the study is to draw some inferences of how wetland restorations benefit salmon, he said, and if the results are definitive enough, could affect how and where that work occurs. This is Edward Stratton of the Daily Astorian for Coast Community Radio.
Veterans, business leaders, and outdoor adventurers from across the state have come together for a new campaign to protect the Owyhee Canyonlands. The coalition Wild for the Owyhee is calling on lawmakers to permanently protect more than 2 million acres of land in southeast Oregon. Jim Hammett is a hunter who enjoys the Owyhee for its solitude. He's worried some potential uses of the land without protection could harm its recreational value.
One of the things that has come up are energy corridors. In other words, corridors for transmission of gas, oil, and electricity, as well as wind generation and other things.
Hammett says fears that additional protections would do away with road networks and other barriers to access inside the Owyhee are unfounded. Robin Jansen is a river guide on the Owyhee. She says no one will be pushed out of this unique landscape if it's given more protection.
A lot of people have come to the table to really make this work for everyone. And it's not just one group of people saying, well, we want to do this and you can't do this. And I think that's a great way to handle these types of protections.
Veteran Chad Brown is founder of Soul River, a company that takes inner city kids and veterans to remote places in the Northwest to connect them with the outdoors. He says the Owyhee is one of Soul River's destinations because of its tranquility and lack of development.
This is a jewel, and it's raw, and it's wild, and it should be kept like that and respected.
A petition to call on lawmakers to protect the Owyhee can be found at wildfortheowyhee.org. The conservation group Cascadia Wildlands filed an ethics complaint this week against three Oregon state representatives. The group says the lawmakers misrepresented House Bill 4040, which approved the state's decision to remove the gray wolf from the endangered species list. Last month, the Oregon Court of Appeals cited the bill when it threw out a challenge to the Fish and Wildlife Commission's decision. Nick Cady is the legal director of Cascadia Wildlands. He said lawmakers assured his group the bill would not affect the judicial review of the delisting.
The main problem with this bill is that the talking point in Salem behind the bill was that it would not influence our lawsuit, our judicial review in any way. And that was just blatantly not true.
The complaint was filed against Representatives Greg Barreto, Sal Esquivel, and Brad Witt, all Republicans. It says they repeatedly denied that the bill would hamper judicial review of the delisting. The legislator said the bill passed simply to confirm the Fish and Wildlife Commission's decision. There were about 80 gray wolves in Oregon at the time the Fish and Wildlife Commission made its decision in November. While the species has made an impressive recovery since it first listed as endangered, Katie says the process is now being derailed.
That is a huge wildlife success story that we should all be celebrating. But instead, we have to spend our time organizationally and as a state fighting resistance to this recovery.
Cascadia Wildlands, Oregon Wild, and the Center for Biological Diversity challenged the decision in December. They argued that it was not based on the best available science, and even though the gray wolf populations are recovering, the groups contend delisting is still too premature to give the species a viable chance in the state. Now the bridge goes to the Pribilof Islands with ace reporter John Ryan. Ryan has been on the case of the vanishing seals, and we have his report this morning.
The case of the vanishing seals.
An Alaskan island mystery.
From KUCB News in Unalaska, this is Seal, a marine mammal mystery told in bite-sized chunks. I'm John Ryan. The story is true.
An Alaskan island mystery.
I'm sitting in the middle of the Bering Sea, or to be more precise, I'm sitting in a viewing blind on St. Paul Island. I'm about 500 miles from Siberia and about 300 miles from the Alaskan mainland. I'm also sitting in the middle of one of the world's largest gatherings of mammals. Every summer, hundreds of thousands of northern fur seals converge on the beaches of St. Paul. More of these fur seals come ashore here than anywhere else on Earth. There's too many to count, but I can see thousands of seal pups and mothers on the rocks and tundra all around me. It's so many that it's hard to believe that many, many more seals used to come to this island. Commercial hunting stopped decades ago, but the seals' numbers are still plummeting nearly 5% a year. I've come to St. Paul to try to understand why and what it means for the Aleut people who also depend on the Bering Sea for their survival.
We are people of the seals.
Greg Freitas Sr. is a tribal elder on St. Paul.
The fur seals are declining fast. They're dying.
The world's largest village of Aleut or Unungan people is here on St. Paul. Greg Freitas has been hunting here since he was six.
1951, the first time I ever worked with the fur seals. I'm going to be 75, and every chance I get, I hunt.
Aleuts were the labor force for commercial seal hunts that used to kill tens of thousands of seals a year. Russian traders and later the American government made big money selling seal furs for high fashion. These days, Aleut natives take just a few hundred seals a year for subsistence.
I really rely on my native food. The fur seal, all the birds, the ducks, and everything.
On St. Paul and nearby St. George Island, food from the outside world is pricey. Freitas says eating that Western food also makes people of the Pribilof Islands, the people of the seals, unhealthy.
I did that too, and now I'm taking medications to control my high blood pressure, diabetes, cholesterol, because of that food. So I prefer my native food.
Seal meat's not as popular as it used to be, but Freitas says it's still the most important local food on these isolated islands. Eighth grader Carly Bordakovsky has started joining the subsistence hunts on St. Paul.
Like every summer I go. Sometimes I watch, like, to keep the herd not going off anywhere. I just keep it in a big circle.
I interviewed Carly during a school field trip. The teenagers were learning how to hunt sea lions.
Last week, my family, we went out to that camp house over there, and they boiled, I forgot what it's called, some Aleut word, but they boiled seal, and it's really good, and I like the heart. Heart's really good.
Compared to the number of fur seals still out there, or even the number of seals that disappear each year, the local seal hunt for local food is very small. And the island rookeries where the seals breed and raise their young are strictly protected. Whatever's making seals disappear, it must be happening where they spend most of their lives, out in the Bering Sea and the North Pacific. Or is it?
I need to catch these guys before they interrupt any more seals.
Can I follow you or should I not?
The Case of the Vanishing Seals.
An Alaskan Island Mystery.
Paul Melavidoff is sitting in his pickup truck by a beach at the edge of the village of St. Paul, in the middle of the Bering Sea. Outside his truck, it's too windy to do a radio interview. Wave after wave pounds the shore. The wind off the Bering Sea sends white spray blasting across the black beach. Melavidoff works for the tribal government of St. Paul Island. Like many Aleut or Unungan natives, he has a Russian last name, inherited from ancestors who were baptized into the Russian Orthodox Church 2 centuries ago. Melavidoff works to monitor fur seal populations and protect their habitat.
I see the decline in front of me on a daily basis.
More northern fur seals breed on St. Paul Island than anywhere else on Earth. Maybe a quarter mile down the beach, we can just make out dark lumps in the tall grass. It's a rookery of fur seals.
The pups are malnourished. You know, they're not fed properly through that short summer feeding period. When it comes time in the fall for them to actually leave the island, they're not ready. A lot of them, I'm sure, die off when they leave. I have to go. Yeah, okay. I have to go.
Melavidoff has just noticed that 2 men who walked past us down to the beach have gone all the way into the seal rookery. He starts up his truck and speeds off to intercept them.
I need to catch these guys before they interrupt any more seals.
While zooming down the gravel roads of the island, he makes a call to the tribe's head of law enforcement.
Hey, you got some trespassers. Yeah, they passed the black bluffs and they're into that cove area. I'm heading down that way right now.
He parks by a sand dune, then we bushwhack over the dunes toward the men. The wind pounds our backs and flattens the tall dune grass. As the men come into view, the wind carries his voice toward the small figures, but they don't respond. Melavidoff keeps shouting. He waves his arms in the air like he really does care. Some of the seals are running away from the 2 men. Fur seals are built for swimming, but they can do a sort of clumsy gallop on their flippers. From a distance, with their heads in the air and their chests off the ground, they look a bit like bears loping across the tundra. Finally, the men respond to Melavidov's shouts. It is hard to hear anything over the wind and the surf. They leave the seals and walk back toward us. Once they get close, Melavidoff tells them they've gone into an area that's closed off to protect the fur seals.
There's a sign right up here.
The men aren't from St. Paul. They're both carrying reindeer antlers they found on the beach. The one who does all the talking says they didn't see the sign and didn't mean any harm. He asks why the seals are so protected. Melavidoff tells him it's the seals' island. They were here first. It's pretty rare for outsiders to walk right up and disturb the seals like that, but many people on St. Paul are convinced that outsiders are harming the seals, and not just any outsiders.
The draggers, they're the culprits here.
Who are the draggers, and are they the culprits? On Seal.
The rookery is a very dangerous place.
This is The Bridge for the week of May 5th. Stay tuned for part two of The Case of the Vanishing Seals.
St. Paul Island sits 300 miles west of the Alaskan mainland. It's pretty much the outer perimeter of the last frontier. The island is home to the world's largest Aleut village and the world's largest population of northern fur seals. Many people on this remote outpost in the Bering Sea believe the fishing industry is behind the drastic decline of fur seals. Here's tribal elder Greg Freitas Sr.
The food source is being taken away by the fishing industry, the draggers. They're the culprits here.
On St. Paul, dragger is almost a dirty word. It's the nickname for the big factory trawlers that come up from Seattle to work the Bering Sea. They drag giant nets through the depths. These massive boats aim to catch high-volume fish like pollock and sole. Accidentally, they catch and throw away more halibut than the local halibut boats reel in on purpose. Halibut fishing from small boats is a mainstay of the St. Paul economy. There's no love lost between people on St. Paul and the draggers, but are draggers the culprits when it comes to disappearing fur seals?
We don't have that evidence right now. That's one of the things we're trying to figure out.
Tom Gillette is a fur seal researcher with NOAA. The Federal Oceans and Atmosphere Agency does a lot of research. It also manages Alaska's most lucrative fisheries.
I think that the cause of the decline is still up in the air, and we're still trying to figure out why.
Northern fur seals eat mostly fish, and mostly pollock. If you've had McDonald's Filet-O-Fish, you've had pollock from the Bering Sea, too. Close to half of all seafood hauled in from U.S. waters comes from the Bering Sea.
The volume of fish, of biomass in the Bering Sea, is really large, and we fish it quite lightly compared to other areas.
Lori Swanson works for the Groundfish Forum in Seattle. Her group represents 18 factory trawl boats that fish in the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska.
Fishing effort is not, I don't think, the driving force in the marine mammal population.
The federal government has put millions of dollars into studying fish and mammals in the Bering Sea. Tom Gillette leads a team of seal researchers. Sometimes their work is surprisingly low tech.
Today we're going to go out and we're going to apply more tags on pups.
I spoke with Gillette outside NOAA's field station on the outskirts of St. Paul. It was as close as I could get to seeing the researchers work. The federal permit letting them tag the seals doesn't let any non-essential personnel, like, you know, a visiting journalist, tag along. When Gillette says tags, he means yellow plastic tags.
I mean, these are truly the same tags that someone might put on their cattle or their goats or pigs in the stockyard, and we can put them into the flipper. It takes about 2 seconds. Hopefully that tag stays in for life.
Since the seals come back to the same beach every year, the numbered yellow tags let researchers see which seals live, breed, or die year to year. Gillette says they've ruled out some suspects, like disease or even radiation from Japan, but they still can't say what is making seals disappear.
There's a lot of mystery out there that we're trying to get to.
Studying fur seals isn't easy, and not just because they spend most of their lives underwater.
The rookery is a very dangerous place for people because those are large animals with big sharp teeth.
Male seals can weigh 600 pounds, females only about 100. Gillette says all the seals can be dangerous.
Even the pups. We call them little Tasmanian devils sometimes. They really can move fast, and you have to be careful with them too.
While federal scientists say more research is needed to crack the case of the vanishing seals, a Canadian researcher thinks it's been cracked.
One group is taking adults, the other group are taking the babies.
Who's taking who? Final episode of Seal. On the Pribilof Islands, Aleut or Unungan natives call themselves the people of the seals. Many people there say the fishing industry is to blame for the steep decline of the world's largest population of northern fur seals. Federal biologists say more research is needed to understand why seals have been vanishing from the Bering Sea. But a Canadian researcher says the cause is known, and it's not the fishing industry.
My name is Andrew Trites. I'm a professor at the University of British Columbia.
Trites has been studying the diets of fur seals. Seals do their underwater hunting mostly at night, so it's nearly impossible to observe them eating. So how do you figure out what they eat?
Collect their fecal samples, and they commonly use their resting places as their bathrooms, and with baggies and spoons, we can collect those samples.
Trite says scooping poop on the tundra of St. Paul Island is actually a nice break from the usual routine in front of a computer.
You know, it's really therapeutic.
And combined with microscopic analysis of the tiny fish bones in that seal poop, the dirty work on the tundra has led to a surprising conclusion. North America's largest fishery and the Northern Hemisphere's largest population of marine mammals, well, they both rely on the same fish species, yet they're not competing for the same fish.
Both groups, people and animals, are depending on the pollock. One group is taking adults, the other group are taking the babies.
But if the pollock fishery isn't taking away the seal's food, why would seal pups be malnourished? Trite says it's nature, not humans, doing the damage. Essentially, the Bering Sea has been getting less nutritious for the seals.
They're finding lots of juvenile pollock to eat, but pollock are very lean, and they contain very little fat.
A seal living on pollock is like you or me living on celery.
And if you're a seal, or a whale, or a seabird that's living in an extremely cold ocean, you need high calories.
Since long before humans started messing with it, the North Pacific has flipped between colder and warmer conditions. When the Pacific flips for a year or so, we call it El Niño. When it flips for decades at a time, scientists call it a regime shift. And that's what happened in the Bering Sea in the 1970s. As the ocean flipped naturally to a warmer state, the new conditions favored lean fish like pollock that humans like to turn into fish sticks. Fatty, oily fish that seals prefer didn't do so well.
Ocean conditions play such a huge role, and most of that is out of our control.
Except this time, whether the North Pacific gets a chance to flip back to a colder state might be up to us. Carbon pollution is making the whole world warmer, and the far north is heating up fastest of all. A warmer Bering Sea with fewer seals and fewer seabirds may be the new normal. People on St. Paul remain skeptical that the fishing industry is off the hook. They say that taking billions of pounds of flesh from the Bering Sea each year has to affect the seals and fish that St. Paul depends on. Paul Melavidov is with the St. Paul Aleut Tribe's Ecosystem Office.
We're being fished in all kinds of directions, and I'm sure it has a large impact on the habitat of a lot of these marine mammals.
But if Andrew Trites is right, fur seals' prospects in the Bering Sea depend mostly on one thing: how fast human beings can wean themselves from the fossil fuels that are heating the planet. Seal has been a production of KUCB News in Unalaska, Alaska, with support from the Institute for Journalism and Natural Resources. Theme music written and performed by me. Reporting from St. Paul Island, I'm John Ryan.
That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. Our thanks to Edward Stratton of The Daily Historian and the great team at KUOW. Thanks, John Ryan. If you missed any part of the show or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening. Join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.